LibroFM lets you purchase audiobooks directly from your favorite local bookstore. Choose from more than 150,000 audiobooks, including New York Times bestsellers and recommendations from booksellers around the country. With LibroFM, you'll get the same audiobooks at the same price as the largest audiobook company out there. You know what one we're talking about, but you'll be part of a much different story, one that supports community.
If you're new to audiobooks, they're the perfect way to get more books into your busy life. Listen while doing chores, walking the dog, or just relaxing at home. All you need is a smartphone and the free LibroFM app.
If you already love audiobooks and don't know what to listen to next, check out recommendations and curated lists from the people who know audiobooks best, local booksellers.
Listeners of the Bookstore Podcast can get a 2-month audiobook membership for the price of 1 month.
Go to LibroFM, that's LIBRO.FM, and enter bookstore at checkout. With each listen, take pride in knowing that you're supporting local bookstores.
Okay, all right. Are you ready?
I am.
Welcome to the bookstore.
It's like a book club, but we actually read the book.
I'm Becca.
And I am Corinne. So this week we read Hurricane Season by Fernando Melchor, and I think we're just going to start discussing it, though first we should probably do a bit of a content warning.
Yeah, if you've read the book, you already know why we have this content warning out. If you haven't read the book, pretty brutal in what it describes, so because that is a lot of the main plot and what the characters do, what happens to the characters, we're going to discuss it. So don't be listening around anyone who you don't want to hear that sort of topics. Yeah.
And it's pretty much every type of violence. So if that's something that is not good for you, then you know what's best. So that's okay. We'll be back next week with something different.
Yes.
Do you want to go ahead with the summary?
Yes. So Hurricane Season by Fernando Melchor was published in English by New Directions in March of this year. It was translated into English by Sophie Hughes. It was published in Spanish in 2016 by Literatura Random House. Is this Melchor's debut?
I'm not sure. That's not something I've looked into.
I'm not sure, but on the back, it does say that she is widely recognized as one of the most exciting new voices of Mexican literature. So if it's not her debut, she is like a new and upcoming writer. Yeah.
It looks like she has several books. I don't know if they're all novels necessarily, but yeah, there's a few.
Hurricane Season is set in a small town in Mexico, and it revolves around the murder of someone called the Witch. Each chapter features a different character, mostly a lot about the extreme violence in their daily lives and what they struggle with, and how they are connected to the witch and her murder. It's kind of hard. There's a lot of things that happen because every character kind of almost goes through their life story.
Mm-hmm. Where should we begin with it?
Well, I will say too, in the description of what this book is about, like on the inside flap, it says the discovery of her corpse propels a small village into the investigation of this murder. I wouldn't really call it an investigation.
No, yeah.
But it does, the more each character, as each character is introduced and they talk about what's happening with them and what they witnessed in regards to the witch, you do kind of find out more about it. So by the end of the book, you do know exactly what happened to the witch.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I think for me, I think like the setting was maybe a little bit confusing because there were like a couple of different places nearby that mm-hmm. people would go to, so it was hard to tell if like this was like one city and then some like surrounding like smaller rural communities near this also sort of rural city. So I guess maybe I didn't necessarily get the feeling that it was just like a village trying to figure it out, and especially not because of the fact that the stories were really much more personal and not specifically about discovering what happened to her so much as that's just what happens throughout the course of the story. But yeah, you know, you can't always get jacket copy exactly right, so I guess maybe I don't need to be so nitpicky.
Yeah.
Probably one of the first things you notice reading it is the style that it's written in. Do you want to just describe that and how you felt about it?
Yeah, so there's no paragraphs and very few sentences. And you notice that, but I wouldn't say that it's really like confusing to read it that way. It kind of just makes it a little bit like a really almost fast-paced with what the characters are thinking and doing.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does. I think the interesting thing that it does is like it's told third person for the most part. So it'll be telling you what a character is thinking and doing instead of like the character telling you what they are thinking and doing. It's really interesting because it's, I don't know how many times I've seen like a third person be so kind of conversational, like almost like that like the third person is the first person telling me. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It doesn't read in a very confusing way because it flows in the way that conversation flows. The way that like when you're talking to somebody, you may not have the end of a sentence. You might just tack on an and keep going and then tack on another and keep going. And then maybe there's like a slight diversion in the middle, but it's related to what you're talking about. So then you keep going from there and then meet back up. It wasn't confusing in the way that I expected it to be. And the way that like when you're confronted with a structure like this, it can sort of seem overwhelming. I actually really liked it and it moved quickly, which surprised me a lot.
Yeah, I feel the same. It really feels like you are in the characters' heads without it being, you know, first person kind of thing. And it made it like you felt, I don't know, I felt like I knew the characters like pretty quickly.
Yeah.
With it and got to know like what kind of a person they were. And it is interesting in how each chapter sort of starts out with the character and the witch, or how they know the witch or what they think of the witch. And then by the end of it, like we go through sort of their life story or a lot of it. And then by the end of it, we circle back to the witch.
Right.
And I thought that was just like sort of a fascinating way of using time because, again, it wasn't confusing at all. It sounds like it's going to be very confusing, but the way Melchor is able to write it is it makes sense how it goes.
I think it must have been, I wonder if it would have been, I guess. I have no idea because I've never translated anything except for like short paragraphs for Spanish homework. But I wonder if it was a really challenging style to translate or not. I don't know. Must have been really interesting. A slight tangent. The other thing I want to say about the style is that the language is rough, is very coarse. I don't necessarily have a problem with that, but yeah, I mean, it's just, it's really interesting. And I think like also very sort of revealing about the way that these people view their lives and the people in their lives. And kind of like the way that they're stuck in their life too, which becomes like more and more evident like as it moves on.
Yeah, the use of language was interesting. Not that I like enjoy reading about somebody calling somebody like every name under the sun and slurs and everything else, but right. It did ring true to me. These characters are, you know, they're very poor. They've all been abused. They all have abused, and they don't really have anything to look forward to in life, and they don't have much education, if any at all. So this is most likely how they would speak to each other and about other people.
I don't know how to say this in like a way that doesn't make me sound like super judgmental, but I mean, I do come from a small town. Nothing on this level, obviously, but I know people who speak this way.
Mm-hmm.
So it felt like very authentic to me. So that really carried through. And I think, it just was true to the people that she was creating.
Yeah. And it showed why they spoke like that, because no matter what, like how old the character was, they all kind of speak like that. And it shows that this isn't really anything. This is just what they've grown up doing. Everybody around them speaks this way. So how would they know? How would you know to not use that type of language if you've never had an example of somebody not using that language?
Right. At first, I, like, you know, sometimes when some of the slurs would come up and get used, I would, like, stop and ask myself, like, is this, like, what is this doing in talking about gay people or whatever, or, like, the way that, like, women are treated necessarily? And is this doing anything to, like, make a point about it? Or is it just kind of glorifying the awful things that people can do to each other? And so there was a lot of time that I spent, like, wondering and waffling about whether or not, like, this was, you know, just some sort of, like, misery porn, essentially, mm-hmm. or if it had something more to say about these topics. And I think, weirdly enough, ultimately, I came down on it might have had more to say. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Well, I think it's hard because some of the scenes of abuse, of sexual abuse and rape, were really, really rough to read. Mm-hmm. But I also recognize that the purpose of those scenes were to make me want to vomit. They were to make me, like, want to cry and be disgusted and everything else. And so in that, it did accomplish what it was doing.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I think about other times in books where I know a certain scene is supposed to elicit some kind of emotion from me, and I don't feel that kind of emotion from it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess I think the book was very successful in that it did make me feel like how it wanted me to feel. I didn't feel like, oh God, like eye-rolly, or felt like it was overdone.
I think especially just like in the dynamics, or maybe not even dynamics, but just the way that, like, these communities, or I don't know if I want to speak that broadly, but like this community in particular, like the way that just kind of just super toxic masculinity, to use a
yes.
buzzword, kind of becomes like the only thing to hold on to. And that that I think is like the, you know, a broader point that it's making. I don't know if we want to speak more specifically.
Yeah, well, let's talk about the witch a little bit.
Yeah.
So the witch's mother was the, like, OG witch, and
yes.
She was the mistress of a really wealthy man named Don Manolo. And Don Manolo lived with the witch's mother in this sort of huge mansion. And eventually he dies, and his sons, who are not the witch's mother's sons, of Don Manolo's real wife, or legal wife, I should say, his sons believe that the witch's mother had something to do with it. Because right. the witch's mother is involved in, like, folk remedies and things like that with healing.
Mm-hmm.
And so the sons come and try to, I can't even remember, get money from the witch's mother.
Yeah.
Is that what they want to do?
Like, take the estate, essentially, because
yeah.
it's on a bunch of land. And that's why there's so much money, because it's, like, in the middle of a bunch of, like, sugarcane.
Yeah.
Fields or something. Yeah.
And they end up dying in an accident. And so everybody in town, or everybody in the surrounding area, believes that the witch's mother cursed them. And that's why they died. So that's sort
right.
of how the witch sort of became the witch, is because her mother was believed to be, like, imbued with all of these powers.
Mm-hmm.
And then townspeople start noticing the witch as a little girl, and they believe that the witch's mother had sex with the devil.
Oh, right. Yes, I forgot about that part.
Yeah.
I read that a while ago. Yeah. I guess, like, the origin story of the witch kind of gets lost because it's at the very beginning, and then immediately you're kind of, like, dumped into somebody else's like whole life story and the dramas that are ensuing there. And so I think I kind of forgot mm-hmm. some of that. You know, I like the idea, like, of a witch. First of all, I like the atmosphere of a story that has one. That's always fun and kind of, like, gothic. But I especially liked, like, the parts where it described how, essentially, like, even though women would be, like, kind of scared or wary of her, they all went to her for help, and it was basically almost like therapy. And if you mm-hmm. can imagine, like, a place like this where women are not treated well by their partners or, you know, society at large, I really liked the idea of, like, there being a woman there to listen and try to help them. So I liked that aspect of the witch's story.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was the witch or the witch's mother, or maybe
the
both.
Witch.
Okay.
Because in the end, because the witch actually starts, when her mother's still alive, she starts making people pay rent because people are, like, living on their land.
Oh, yes.
They own different properties. And so that's how she is able to stay alive and feed herself and her mother. And she also makes people start paying her mother for their, you know, remedies or what have you. And then after her mother dies, she continues to provide all the services. And that's when it actually says that she doesn't charge any of the sex workers for anything,
right.
Which really I think was the witch, I think, is probably my favorite character. Maybe, I don't know, I have sympathy for all of the characters, but I think the witch is the only one who never did anything bad to anyone.
Yeah.
So maybe I would say she's the best one. I don't know.
Well, I mean, you know, there's Norma, who's just a child. So
yeah, I mean, I know that.
One's just rough. That one's not.
That one's pretty bad. But yeah, and I do think the witch is an interesting character too, because when we get to almost the end of the book, can we spoil everything?
Yeah, why not? Here's a spoiler.
Okay. With Brando's story, I think it's sort of implied that there's some, like, I don't know, the way he refers to the witch is makes me think that maybe the witch has some sort of, like, different identity or different gender going on as well.
I assumed, because, well, at first, the way it's described is basically that, like, the witch has orgies and, like, pays people to come have sex with her. I don't know, like that. And then as it goes on, it's kind of revealed that I think she's probably would be considered transgender,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, what was interesting about that, I think, is the way that you get, like, the perspective of the townspeople who are it's not like they're not familiar with the idea of transgender people existing, because, like, they talk about all the people that come in for, like, carnival and stuff, but I guess, like, the way that they speak about transgender people is kind of interesting and revealing about, like, the way that they express and experience gender and stuff.
Yeah, I think that's interesting, because that's why I don't know. That's why I don't know how much we can trust Brando with what he says, because Brando has. He has a very complicated feelings on his own sexuality. And so I don't know whether he's projecting something onto the witch or if he really knows something.
It does really kind of play into, like, the really complicated dynamics of gender in a society like that, especially where women are, like, kind of abused de facto.
Maybe we can talk about Brando a little bit since we're on the subject.
Sure.
I think with his story, it was maybe the best example of how the toxic masculinity that you're talking about, because Brando has gay feelings. He is attracted to men, but he can't really, he can act upon them, but it has to be in this very specific way
mm-hmm.
that makes him still be able to maintain his, like, heterosexuality, which is, it's very strange. Essentially, his friends will make fun of him, but and make fun of other people for being gay, but it's okay for them to receive from gay men.
And not only that, but, like, I mean, they talk about also having, like, not even just receiving, but, like, performing sexual acts with gay men but, like, only so long as they're, like, getting paid for it, or in payment would be, like, I don't know, drugs or whatever too. But it's I don't know, it's such a really complicated idea of, like, staying hyper masculine mm-hmm. throughout all of that, as though, like, homosexuality is the opposite of masculinity, because, you know, like, whatever. But yeah, I don't know, it's a really interesting kind of look at the way that people view all, like, that whole spectrum and what it means for your gender. And it's... Yeah.
Because I think about, like, Brando and his friends are always, what do I want to say? They're, like, always in the position of power when it comes to their sexual relationships with
right.
other men. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of shows them that to them, heterosexuality and masculinity is really just about being in power and not being
right.
the one who is... I mean, I don't know, maybe, I guess, showing their fear of being the victim.
Yeah.
They want to be the one who is the abuser before they get abused. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know that I've ever quite seen, like, that dynamic displayed before. And it's really, fascinating is the wrong word, but I'm not sure. I mean, it tracks, like, for the way that you think about, you know, like, homophobia and stuff, too, in terms of it being, like you said, a power dynamic thing and the fear of being perceived as weak or feminine or...
Yeah, which is kind of, I mean, a lot of that, this book is about that. Like, what happens when you just have rampant misogyny
right.
in a community? Like, this is what happens. I will say I found Moonra the least interesting.
Yeah.
Out of everybody. So Moonra is Louise Mee's mom, Shabella's husband. No, wait. Okay, yes. Louise Mee's mom, her husband is Moonra.
Yes. So he's his stepfather.
Yes. And he is disabled and he lives off of his wife's earnings, basically, and he was the sort of like the getaway driver for Louise Mee and Brando when they murder the witch.
Mm-hmm.
And his story, I feel like you don't even really learn. He's the one that I don't think you learn too much about him, but you do learn more about Louise Mee and Norma from him.
Yeah, because, I mean, like, this introduces Louise Mee. Well, I mean, it's interesting how I think, like, probably, like, the central relationship in this story that you would want to understand is the one between the witch and Louise Mee, but those mm-hmm. are the two perspectives that you don't get at all, so you just get, like, what happens around them and two people who are at different times close to them. So, yeah, I think that's really interesting. So, I mean, I guess in some ways, maybe we should talk more about Louise Mee in order to explain who he is, I guess.
Yeah.
I think we sort of mentioned that he has a relationship with the witch that is, I think it's like an affair, essentially, or, you know, they're together. Yeah. And eventually he does end up murdering her, but in between there, we find out that he is a drug addict. He's addicted to pills. And he spends most of his days either sleeping in his little, like, cinderblock shack that's in the back of his mother's house, or waking up and then finding a way to get more pills to then kind of black out again. I can imagine his story wouldn't necessarily be that interesting. But at the same time, the fact that, like, his choices are kind of what propel everything in this, and getting everybody else's stories is an interesting choice, I suppose. So, yeah, Moonra's story is mostly to kind of talk about, I think, Louise Mee and what he tends to spend his days doing, because in a lot of ways, Moonra is also not a particularly productive person, but his reason is that he's disabled.
Well, and I will say, I think Moonra's story did show what happens when you just go along with other people,
because
Moonra really doesn't make any decisions himself.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of interesting because he would, in this cast of characters, he would almost be a good guy.
Yeah.
If it weren't for the fact that he's just like, okay, you murdered that girl. Okay, I'll drive you, but I need $50. You know, yeah. He just, and he's very upset by it, of course. He's like very shaken up about it, but he ultimately really doesn't do anything. But I mean, what would you do in a community like this, you know?
Yeah, and I think, you know, partially it's like everyone, not everyone, but many of the people here are addicts. I think like there is basically nothing for them to do in this town. There's like oil fields around which you could maybe get a job at, and then there's like the cane industry, like the sugar industry or whatever, but like all of the money is going somewhere else, so these people don't have any chance at upward mobility. And so it kind of becomes this like life cycle of coping and then partying and whatever else. And I think Munro's story in a way sort of shows that, even though like he claims he's not part of that community, like he still spends most of his days just getting drunk and then falling asleep too.
Yeah.
If anything, it must be like, my life's not much fun, but like it must be just painful and boring to not have any options.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, he kind of numbed, and in some ways, like he also is, he's like trying to prove that he's like tough and like machismo, but his wife is a sex worker and he keeps like maybe wanting to assert dominance, but like she's the one who makes their money and he can't leave her either way. I don't know.
I like what you said about him being like everybody, or him being numb because of the community that they're in. And I think that's sort of how Yesenia is.
Mm-hmm.
She is Louise Mee's cousin. She ends up turning in Louise Mee not because she feels badly about the witch, but because she wants to prove to their grandmother that Louise Mee is like useless and a drug addict and now a murderer.
Yeah.
To get her grandmother to stop like babying him and giving him everything. Mm-hmm. And so I think that shows, you know, real dehumanization that a lot of the townspeople have for the witch and for maybe just everybody, each other.
Yeah, Yesenia's story, it was really quite sad. I mean, that's a story about just like abusive family dynamics. Mm-hmm. And it was really sad. The grandmother in this family really only ever cared about her sons. And, you know, I think it also shows you the way that communities like this, and I think maybe even specifically we can talk about like Catholicism and like how, when that has been put into different communities around the world through colonialism and stuff, how that has shaped the way that women are valued in, mm-hmm. in their communities and within their families.
Yeah.
Because the grandmother just like goes off constantly about how every woman that she knows is just a worthless whore, basically. And she knows that these girls are going out and sleeping with the boys and they're all whores. And it's just, yeah, it's really debasing.
And it shows how her grandmother treats Yesenia terribly. And then Yesenia ends up being very physically abusive to her cousins, who she mm-hmm. is tasked with, you know, watching and taking care of all the time. And it's just another example of, when you don't have any good examples, how do you know what you're doing is wrong, or that yeah. there's another way? Because Yesenia doesn't know. So she is now treating, like, her grandmother berates her. So then now she is going to end up doing that. Like, she's continuing the cycle. And that also applies to Norma. Norma's still a child, but, you know, she is abused and she ends up abusing her brothers too.
Yeah, that whole cycle. And I think also it shows like the really, really painful desire to still be like loved and appreciated by the person mm-hmm. who's abusing you.
Yeah.
Which is so complicated. The way that Yesenia's, you know, even as her grandmother is dying, like trying to get the woman to, you know, like show some sort of affection towards her. And then I think also the paths that sets people down to making just like bad and desperate decisions in order to have some sort of like a human connection and affection.
Yeah.
I think that's maybe most pronounced in Norma's, which is absolutely devastating because, yeah, she's a child.
That one's probably, in a book of a lot of horror, that is probably the most horrible.
Yeah.
Really difficult to read. Norma is 13 and she runs away because she is raped by her mother's boyfriend and is pregnant. And Louise Mee actually finds her and takes her in. And they have a really strange sort of relationship as well.
I wanted to ask you about that because I don't think I understand it. I don't necessarily understand, like, what he was trying to do.
I don't know what... Yeah, I think that's the hard part. And like you said, we don't get to know what's inside Louise Mee's head. And I have no idea what was he getting from the witch and what was he getting from Norma.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think I know what he was getting from the witch. I think he was genuinely attracted to the witch and they had a sexual relationship. And obviously, I think they were also tied by a mutual drug addiction of some sort. The witch supplied him with drugs and that. But Norma, I really don't know because he takes her in. They don't really have sex.
No.
She has to initiate. And I think that part, it's so heartbreaking because that's the only way she knows that somebody could show any affection or like love in air quotes, not real love, is through that. And so she tries to have sex with him. But they don't really talk. They don't have any, I don't know. But then he absolutely freaks out when she ends up in the hospital.
And he tells all his friends that he's marrying her.
Yeah.
Or that they are married. And so, yeah, I don't know. Because, like, I mean, I know some fairly irrational people, but I don't know that they would pick up, like, a child off of the street, basically. And I keep calling her a child. She's 13, which is a child, but a teenager at that. A very young teenager. And I don't know any of them who would pick up a kid who is, like, clearly lost, clearly in trouble, clearly needs like very serious help, and then bring them home and say that it's my wife now. So
I don't know.
Yeah, it's such a confusing dynamic.
It's strange because Louise Mee's mom, Chabela, immediately takes to Norma.
Yes.
And is like, okay, you're pregnant. That's fine. Like,
I was worried about her because I thought maybe, well, first of all, I don't think Chabela knew how old she was, but also, Chabela kind of describes how when she was a young teen, she was very sexually promiscuous. So she kind of like projects this idea that the kid is like intentionally sexual, mm-hmm. I think, because when she finds out that she's pregnant. And I think my fear was that her obtaining the abortion for Norma was in order to maybe start pimping her out. That was my fear.
Oh, yeah.
Because she talks for a little bit about how now that she's older, she gets, you know, younger girls and she helps them out. Yeah. And she doesn't have to work quite as much anymore. And yeah, that was my concern.
I didn't think about that.
But I don't know for sure.
But I would say Norma did seem to want the abortion.
Yeah, well, Norma, I mean, originally she was planning on jumping off a cliff. So, like, she didn't run away to leave. She ran away to die, basically.
Yeah. So you find out, you know, with all this, we find out more and more pieces of what happened. And essentially, Brando decides that they need to steal the witch's rumored treasure trove of gold coins in order mm-hmm. to flee from the town and make a new life in Cancun. And he wants Louise Mee to come with him because Brando wants a relationship with Louise Mee.
Yes.
And they sort of, I would say, accidentally murder the witch. Not accidental, but they hurt her bad enough to where they realize she's suffering, she's not going to get better, and so then they kill her.
Yeah, Brando at the end there was really, really kind of off the rails because he talked about maybe killing his mom and mm-hmm. he talked about how he should have killed Louise Mee. And I think like that is kind of like the epitome of the toxic masculinity in there. And I mean, he almost like abducts a child at the end. It gets incredibly dark. And then for it, to just, I don't know. He was kind of like this lit fuse already. I don't know.
Well, and it sort of shows how when he goes over and talks about when he's young, it almost feels like he could have been a different person. But mm-hmm. because of what he went through, like this is, he just kept getting worse and worse. because it talks about how he was this like little boy who like held his mother's hand and walked across the street, and then he becomes a murderer and almost child kidnapper.
I think maybe I'll read a quote, and it may not be a great quote because it probably sort of like, in a way, it's the part at the very end that made me realize that the book did have like a point of view with all this, and it wasn't just like, you know, a murder porn sort of situation. After the murders, and they do end up in jail, but like, it doesn't seem like it's probably very hopeful that anybody's really going to receive justice, because the cops are like also just interested in perhaps like finding the witch's room of gold and jewels or whatever that everyone has kind of mythologized. Oh God, it's so hard to pick a place to start because these are such long sentences. So I'll start here. They say that's why women are on edge, especially in La Matosa. They say that come evening, they gather on their porches to smoke filterless cigarettes and cradle their youngest babes on their arms, blowing their peppery breath over those tender crowns to shoo away mosquitoes. And then it goes on for almost a paragraph. A look warning them not to let their children go looking for that treasure, not to dream of going down there with their friends to rummage through those tumble-down rooms, or to see who's got the balls to enter the room upstairs at the back and touch the stain left by the old witch's corpse on the filthy mattress, to tell their children how others have run screaming from that place, faint from the stench that lingers inside, terror-stricken by the vision of a shadow that peels itself off the walls and chases you out of there, to respect the dead silence of that house, the pain of the miserable souls who once lived there. That's what the women in town say. There is no treasure in there, no gold or silver or diamonds or anything more than a searing pain that refuses to go away. And I think that just was really the point where I was like, oh, like, so this is like, I mean, it definitely is about like how women and the least powerful people in this town bear the brunt of all of the ills of society, like all the way down from the top. And it's almost like, not necessarily their duty, but it is in some ways their lot in life to have to just keep moving on with it.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, it's incredibly painful, but I thought that was also a very beautiful way to describe like the things that women know because of the things that women have had to experience.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting, too, because I think maybe people can read this book and just kind of think, oh, this is just a conga line of trauma.
Yeah.
You know, but it's really not. It does have a point. You just can't like get distracted by all the slurs, I guess. There is a point to talking about all of this trauma.
Yeah, I read that while I listened to it, The Devil All the Time. I think they're making a film out of it now. It's by Donald Ray Pollock. And that one, like, in some ways, like, I sort of feel like there are similarities, because in some ways this book is like a crime story and it's kind of a horror story, but it's like a very kind of like human-based horror story. Mm-hmm. And The Devil All the Time is sort of like that in a, it's, you know, it's like, it's got like these dual lines of like, there's like a serial killer couple, and then there's this crazy cult, religious cult, Christian religious cult thing going on. But it's very, very brutal. But this one, I feel like, has the perspective of, you know, victims, I suppose, where the other one is definitely just looking at, is just looking at the gore and the awfulness.
Yeah.
At least that's what I felt about it. I don't know. Yeah. I was trying to compare it to other books in my head, just because like I had to kind of find a place to classify it because it is so brutal.
Yeah. I kind of thought about Angela Carter. This, I think, is definitely more brutal, but Angela Carter does kind of have the same thing. It's, you know, with some gore, not really gore, but just like brutality. And she also, you know, writes a lot about women and what women go through. So that's what I kind of thought of too.
Interesting book. I know a few of our listeners have really, really enjoyed, is such a, not the, maybe the right word, but have appreciated this novel. So that's why we decided to pick it up. I would say it's definitely not for everyone. Not quite one of those reads, but if you're at all interested in it. I think it's worth the read. The language is incredibly interesting, and it'll give you a lot to think about and also yeah. stuff to not want to think about.
So. Yes. Yeah. And I will say, too, I don't know, we didn't really touch on this, but we sometimes can criticize novels where it's like, where is this? This could be anywhere. There's no real sense of place mm-hmm. or atmosphere. And in this one, I could see the sweat on people. I could feel yeah. the dirt in their homes, the griminess, like everything is feels very, very real, very yes. vivid, I would say. But yeah, this is not going to be for everybody, but I will definitely want to read more of Melchor's books in English.
Yeah, hopefully we'll get some more translations. Yeah. It is an accomplishment.
Well, thanks for listening to The Bookstore.
If you'd like to support the podcast beyond listening, you can check out our Patreon at patreon.com/thebookstore, or you can rate and review us on Apple Podcasts.
And you can find all of the ways to contact us, email, social media, phone line at thebookstorepodcast.com.
Our next book discussion will be The Old Drift by Namwali Sirpal. You can find it at your local bookstore or library and read along with us.
The Bookstore is a production of Awkwardly Social Media, produced by Becca Young and Corinne Keener. Technical and production support is provided by Josh Bourdon and Zach Titus.
And John, if you're out there, thanks for listening.
See you next Tuesday.
Bye.
Bye. Should we start saying our last names in the beginning?